listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from the Latin America and Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. As usual, we have a lot to cover, but let's start with Jimmy Morales, the comedian turned president of Guatemala.
Yeah, Guatemala's interesting, Don, because over the last few weeks, they've done a couple of things that you wouldn't expect a U.S.-friendly right-wing government to do. One of the things that they did about 3 weeks ago now was they abstained in a vote against against Nicaragua in the Organization of American States, where the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights, you know, if you can still call them that, presented what they called their final report, when their investigators actually in Nicaragua had barely even started their investigation. I'm not sure if they had even started their investigative work in Nicaragua, their team of independent investigators, but they don't need proof. They'd already written up their final report based on opposition human rights organizations and opposition news media reports. Right. And so the IACHR presented that farrago to the Permanent Council of the Organization of American States, and as expected, all the U.S. allies voted in favor of accepting the report, except for Guatemala. And then when you look at that, when I was a bit puzzled about that, and I looked at that again, and it became clear that the context of that was the government of Jimmy Morales was extremely resentful of U.S. attempts to set up a kind of parallel legal system, a parallel government in Guatemala, which was, you know, and ironically, that's how Jimmy Morales came to power. The reason he came to power was because the previous president,
right,
Otto Perez, I think his name was,
yes,
was ousted as a result of corruption charges, largely as a result, almost principally as a result, I'd say, of the UN Commission for the Investigation of Corruption and Impunity in Guatemala, which is called CICIG under its Spanish acronym. So CICIG back in those days was part of the structure that helped shoo in Jimmy Morales as a kind of different kind of flavor of the Guatemalan elite to Otto Perez. Jimmy Morales took power, and then he found himself subject to the same kind of harassment.
Right.
As I think is a legitimate word to use.
Yeah, and it only took a month, you know, because he took it. You know, the statement came February of this year against the findings against Venezuela, and in March, the IACHR released a report on Guatemala.
Right. So the situation there is that there's a, same as in the United States, there are continuing internecine turf wars between different sectors of the elite, in this case in a much smaller country, obviously. But basically the pattern's the same as in the United States. You have this kind of turf war,
right,
between different sections of the elite, sections that are more aligned with the United States interests, sections that are only aligned with the United States interests insofar as that's good for them, like, right, Jimmy Morales and his backers, who are largely associated with the Guatemalan military. And so you have this curious situation where this right-wing government is, in fact, legitimately claiming that the CICIG body, this anti-corruption UN body, is being manipulated by the United States, creating a parallel, effectively a parallel structure that challenges the institutional legitimacy of Guatemala. And that's true.
Right.
You know, and so you have this curious situation where this right-wing government is actually telling the truth, you know, which is,
right, yep,
perhaps not a first in Latin America, but it's certainly unusual, you know.
Right.
And so they have taken this line, and that also reflects some, in part, that just reflects the internal reality in Guatemala, where there's a large middle class lobby that is anti-corruption, but that is still kind of, it's a bit like the human rights, the way the human rights motif is used to manipulate,
right,
liberal and progressive opinion in the United States.
Right.
You know, and they, yep, and whenever a country becomes a target for regime change, the first item that comes up on the psychological warfare agenda in the corporate media is the human rights motif.
Right. The
and
second is corruption.
Used,
and corruption is the second one. And the both,
yeah,
are, you know, corruption more so, but both are, you know, non-ideological complaints, although they might come dressed as, you know, being of one or another ideological hue. They're essentially non-ideological. They allege a pattern of fact pattern of wrongdoing that, you know, among a certain group inside the political class, and that authorizes or enables or sanctifies some extra legal or extrajudicial action to remove or negate those players.
Yeah, and in the case of what United States policy in the region, and although it's a kind of a very, you know, well-worn cliche, I mean, what you need to look at in the case of U.S. policy in the region is what are the corporate interests involved? And if you look at what's going on in Guatemala, there's obviously a kind of struggle between those parts of the Guatemalan elite that want to facilitate U.S. corporate interests and other foreign corporate interests, and the kind of nationalist right-wing part of the Guatemalan elite that wants to defend their own share of the pie, right? And so, and you can see that across the region. You see it in Brazil. Why did Eduardo de Cunha get locked up, for example, who was the right-wing president of the lower house in Brazil, who facilitated the coup against Dilma Rousseff and subsequently facilitated, along with the usurper president, was it Michel Temer, the abuse of the judicial system against to prevent the candidacy of Lula da Silva. And why is he in jail? Presumably, and this is just speculation on my part, but presumably because although he was an extreme right winger who to some extent facilitated the US agenda, the political agenda, he seems to have been unwilling to facilitate the corporate agenda of a wholesale selling off of Brazil's patrimony to US corporate elites, which is what is happening under Temer and what is likely to continue to happen should a right-winger get elected in the elections in October in Brazil.
Assuming he doesn't get stabbed.
Sorry, Don.
Assuming that particular right-winger doesn't get stabbed.
Well, yeah, was that all about?
You know, and
that incident in which the right wing favorite, when I say that, I mean the most likely right wing politician to win the Brazilian election. He was stabbed in a very strange incident, apparently by somebody who believed they were acting on the word of God.
Right.
So, you know, and how seriously does one take that? It's impossible to know.
Right.
So then looking again, I'm taking that corruption issue that has been the motif around which the United States has tried to manipulate politics in Guatemala. And staying in the Central American region just for a moment, the reason that that's interesting and that the way the dynamic that's playing out is interesting is because that definitely has implications for what the United States can expect to achieve if it decides to go ahead and implement increasingly severe economic sanctions against Nicaragua, which seems likely. Now, my thing about that is that it's different now. In the 1980s, they were able to get away with those sanctions because Nicaragua wasn't as integrated into Central American economic life as it is now in regional terms. But we all saw what happened when around 400 truckers from across the region were held hostage by the opposition gangs, the violent opposition gangs here during the crisis between April and July of this year. The opposition gangs held hostage around 400 truckers who were responsible for something around 250 of those big articulated trucks that are the actual lifeblood of trade throughout Central America in this region. And so when that happened, what was the result? And after about a month of that, you had the respective ambassadors of the Central American countries complaining to the mediating bishops who were supposed to be mediating the crisis here in Nicaragua about that. And they explicitly stated the damage that was doing to their own economies.
Right.
Okay? So things are different now. And then if the United States attacks the Nicaraguan economy, there'll be knock-on effects in the local regional economy that they have no control over.
Right.
And so maybe they don't care. I mean, they certainly don't care about migrants. They, you know, and some people argue that the United States won't go hell for leather for economic sanctions against Nicaragua because they don't want to worsen the migrant crisis. Well, that seems to me completely stupid.
Right.
What? The corporate elite suddenly developed a conscience about ordinary people in Central America.
Not only
that's
that.
Ridiculous. So, but what is likely to put a brake on U.S. attempts to damage the region is precisely this kind of nationalist feeling Jimmy Morales' decision to refuse to accept the renewal of the CICIG, UN anti-corruption body. And that is an expression of the kind of Central American reality that now exists. And if you want to if you were to deliberately set out to damage the Central American economy, what you'd do is target Nicaragua, because that is the kind of, it's where everything goes to and fro between the rest of the region.
Right.
And the rest of the region, and the rest of the region is Nicaragua's biggest trading partner. So they are the ones that are going to be hit hard by any sanctions against Nicaragua imposed by the US government.
Right.
Let's see how that pans out. Will it make a difference? I don't know. But things are definitely different now in those terms.
Yeah.
And so then when looking at that, and that makes me think about the larger regional reality, which seems to me, and I'd be interested to know what this looks like from your point of view, Don, because to me what it looks like is, we talked about this back in 2015, just after the Argentinian elections, when Mauricio Macri was elected by barely 2% of the vote. He just squeaked through. Why did he squeak through? Because, as usual, the Social Democrats held the door open for him.
Right.
This guy Sergio Massa, who's nominally a Peronist, but he has this strong Social Democrat wing, and they decided to divide the opposition votes, and that opened the door for Macri.
And we saw that actually in the Congress there as well. After Macri got elected, it seemed at first that the left had a sizable majority, but we found out that some of those people were actually voting with Macri's people as soon as they convened.
And that was Sergio Massa. And now what's happening? Now Sergio Massa is desperately trying to distance himself from what he made possible. And Sergio Massa and his Social Democrats are the people that shooed in Macri and shooed in everything that Macri represented, which is economic crisis. And they immediately implemented, just as we said back then, you don't even need to be an amoeba with half a brain to be able to work out what's going to happen with the election of Mauricio Macri. He implemented neoliberal policies, sold out the country's national interest to the vulture funds on Wall Street, brought in, he's now bringing in the army to carry out domestic policing duties. He's reached an agreement with the United States military so that they can have a base in Argentina. Everything that you associate with the right-wing dictatorship from 1976 to 1983, or whatever the actual dates were, and Mauricio Macri is bringing back. And he's also brought back, with a vengeance, the economic crisis of 1999, 2000, 2001.
Right, exactly. That was, we had said back when Macri got elected, and essentially then, it was only after he was elected, laid out, you know, or indicated where he was headed with the economic program, that this was going to lead to exactly the crisis that led to Nestor Kirchner coming to power and repairing and, you know, revitalizing the economy, which continued with Cristina's administration. And what happened? Macri came in. They basically have precipitated a crisis, and the country's almost in the same position that it was back then, with the IMF even saying
it's worse now.
Yeah.
It's much worse now.
And it took 3 years.
It doesn't look like it on the surface, but it's actually, and if you look at the figures, and the national debt's worse, and the economy is in a much worse state, and it's just, and then when you look at that, and let's put that in the wider context, along with the Central American stuff. And if you put all that in the wider context and look at what's happening in Brazil, and what's happening is that the United States corporate elites, who currently have a kind of sales representative selling some flavor of their interests, Donald Trump, but what they are after in Latin America, they know that time is running out for them. They've lost Eurasia. They're trying to consolidate themselves in Latin America, but they can't do it in a democratic way on the basis of the policies that the governments they put into power are putting into place. So you see in Brazil a frantic rush to sell off the public sector resources,
right,
to allow the United States military to participate in Brazilian security policy, and even in their aerospace policy, because there's this very important space station, which is the only space station owned by a sovereign Latin American country in Brazil. And they launch rockets into space. And the United States is taking steps to make sure that they have control of that base. And so in every sense, Brazil's sovereignty and its national patrimony is being sold off to the corporate elites and that will control those resources directly, and to the U.S. military, which is itself controlled by the corporate elites, yeah. You know, the armaments industry and so on. Yeah. And so what's going on is that the United States is in a race against time to extract every last bit of Latin American resources that are worth anything in the period of time that they have left before they stop being a global superpower.
Yeah.
And that's how long will that take? Will it take 3 years? Will it take 5 years? Will it take 10 years? Nobody knows, but that's what's going to happen. Yeah. And the corporate elites know that's what's going to happen. And so that's why they're hammering Latin America and sticking their kind of claws into it to extract as much of Latin America's resources as they can over the next 2 or 3 years. And what does that mean in political terms? How does that translate in political terms into events in Argentina? Well, what you've got there is you've got Sergio Massa trying to displace Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner with the assistance of the extreme right wing and their corrupt judiciary. So he's hoping to become the kind of pseudo-progressive front runner in Argentina, who will then take over from Mauricio Macri. But what will be his role as a social democrat? His role as a social democrat will be to extend the period of resource extraction right. available to U.S. and other corporate elites.
Right.
You know, that is the political reality in Argentina. And if you look at what's going on in Brazil, you have the same kind of process.
Right.
That guy who was stabbed, not seriously injured, who's the main right-wing front-runner for the Brazilian presidency, what is going to be his role should he win? The same, to facilitate continued extraction of Brazilian resources for U.S. and other foreign elites. And you can see, and why... why are we likely to see a tremendous offensive against the re-election of Evo Morales in Brazil? And why do we see in Peru this corruption crisis, another crisis around the corruption motif? We see it because the United States, there will be an attack against Evo Morales in Bolivia. But what's going on there is that Peru and Bolivia have the best relations that they've ever had since the 19th century, is what Evo Morales described the situation as over the weekend. And why is that? You have a right-wing government in Peru. Why are they developing good relations with what in theory should be a target country for them, given the fact that they're a U.S. ally? Well, they're not just a U.S. ally. Peru has a strong projection into the Pacific, across to Asia, as does Bolivia. And they are beneficiaries of the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative.
Right.
Because as we've discussed in program after program, they are the ones that are developing and promoting the transcontinental railway that will transform trade and economic realities in South America and shift the balance away from dependence on the North and the United States, and towards a much closer relationship, a win-win relationship, not a dependency relationship, but a win-win relationship,
right.
Both sides benefit, with China. That's what that is all about. And that is why you can see this attack developing against manipulating the corruption motif in Peru. And that is why we will see an all-out offensive against Bolivia when the elections come around next. I think it's next year. In the same way that we've seen an assault on Nicaragua to try and overthrow the government here and attempt regime change, as they've done in Venezuela And where else have they done it? Ecuador, of course. I mean, right. We could just, there's so much to talk about, Don. Right. And just look at Ecuador in that context.
I know. And
do I we mean, have they time
elected,
to talk
they
about
elected a guy to do something and to, you know, to follow a particular line. That's what he said he was doing. That's his whole career up to that point. He was groomed for the position to continue the work that you know had been well underway for how many terms did the previous president
Rafael Correa.
Yeah,
two,
right? So he was supposed to be like the next term following the same program. The minute he gets in, he turns face. Now he's withdrawing from ALBA. Go through this stuff. But he's, you know, Julian Assange has to worry, for example.
Yeah, and when Lenin Moreno took over in Ecuador, it was actually apparent in the second part of the presidential campaign, because he only won on the second round, and he didn't win by a very big margin either. But in the same way that in Argentina the right wing mounted a successful campaign, claiming that the economic slowdown was due to progressive policies there, and that's what the right wing did in Ecuador. And so they intimidated an extremely weak individual in terms of, in moral terms, Lenin Moreno. They intimidated him into doing a turnabout and essentially betraying the platform on which he was in theory elected. And so he began instituting austerity. He set about to, in an unconstitutional way, in the same way that the judicial and legal system and constitutional system have been abused in Brazil and Argentina, he abused Ecuador's constitutional arrangements. He held a referendum that should have been ratified by the Supreme Court, but never was. So essentially, everything that he's done since then has been illegal, in strict constitutional terms. But he's rigged the courts. He's got this provisional transitional body to which he has nominated, via his proxies, people that do what he says. Right. And essentially what he asks people to do is what the right wing tell him to do. So now he's instituting austerity policies because his economic formula has failed to do what he said it would do. He's threatening to, or he hasn't actually threatened to, but all the signs are, in as many words, but all the signs are he's going to hand Assange over to the United Kingdom authorities, which is essentially a long prison sentence in the United States for Julian Assange. He's withdrawn from the progressive ALBA bloc of countries, and that means that he's almost certainly going to start attacking Venezuela in the Organization of American States, something which to date he has refrained from doing. But that's just the next step. And he's also withdrawn from UNASUR, which is the Union of South American Nations, which is the main body in South America, right, that has fomented a kind of a non-ideological integration, but now the right wing have politicized that. Colombia has announced its withdrawal from UNASUR. Right. Ecuador is likely shortly to withdraw from UNASUR. And so you have this whole series of decisions, and the latest is that the government of Lenin Moreno seems unwilling to contest a judgment by what's called the permanent tribunal for arbitration, that although it's based in The Hague, it's not actually, it doesn't have anything like the prestige and authority of the International Court of Justice.
Right.
But this permanent arbitration tribunal has just issued a judgment in favor of Chevron, the big oil company, which the Ecuadorian government under Rafael Correa had sued for damages, right, by Texaco over many years.
Right.
And then Chevron subsequently took over Texaco, right?
Right.
And Chevron are arguing that they're not liable.
Right.
But the Ecuadorian government has argued that, of course, they're liable because they took over the company,
right,
that was responsible for $1 billion worth of pollution.
Of damage.
Now, here's
the big pile of money that you made destroying our country. Now you own it. Oh, so the people who suffered have no claim to it because it switched owners.
Right, yeah, and the Ecuadorian government should be challenging that.
Right.
They should be appealing it.
But they're not.
They should be doing everything possible at an international level, and they should even do what China did.
Right.
Do you remember that judgment that the same tribunal issued against China in the South China Sea? Well, what did China do? They just ignored it.
Right.
Well, Ecuador could do the same.
That's right.
You know? And so, but they're not. And apparently what they're right. saying is that they're now going to have to sue Rafael Correa
right.
to get back the money that they're going to pay to Chevron.
Mm-mm-mm.
Right?
Mm-mm.
So, and that's amazing. You know, that just shows you the extent. As far as one can see, Lenin Moreno's days are numbered, because his credibility, his popularity ratings in Ecuador haven't yet reached the same level as Mauricio Macri, but they soon will.
They're headed south for sure. We got about a minute left. And so which of these other items do you want to give us a very quick treatment of?
Well, the encouraging thing is in Venezuela, where they seem to, however, their economic reform measures, especially their currency reform measures, are likely to pan out over the next 2 or 3 years. They seem to have taken a decisive series of steps that are going to transform their economy and make them much less vulnerable to the kinds of sanctions and pressure through economic and financial structures dominated by the United States financial elites and their allies in Western Europe. And that's extremely positive for the region.
Yes,
I mean, it may not
yes.
work out 100% as people hope, but it's certainly a beacon of hope.
Yep, it's a start for sure. And Tony, thank you very much. We'll speak with you next week, and maybe we can work that a little more when we get to it next week.
Okay, thanks a million, Don. Good to talk to you.
The same. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
And welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. In the age of Trump, political gridlock has been taken to the next level. There's a lot at stake, a Supreme Court seat and presidential prerogatives. In the end, it's all about the rule of law and equal application of the law. We are gazing into the abyss with compromise unlikely. Crosstalking political gridlock, I'm joined by my guest Lionel in New York. He's a legal analyst and a news decoder at lionelmedia.com. In Las Vegas, we have Jen Kearns. She's a GOP strategist and contributor to The Hill. And in Austin, we cross to Don DeBar. He's an anti-war activist and a host of a daily radio program. All right, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Jen, let me go to you first in Las Vegas. You got up earliest for this program, and it's much appreciated. And looking at the Kavanaugh conference, confirmation process, ironically, for a seat on the highest court of the land where justice is meted out. This has been a mockery of justice. I'm not going to tiptoe around like everybody else. I think this is a mockery. It's a disgrace, and it's purely political. And as I've been saying on this program, with the advent of Donald Trump, that we have the left destroying institutions and credibility in institutions. So you've got my take. I'm very interested in yours. Go ahead.
Well, I would agree with you, Peter. And not only have they made a mockery of the justice system, I think we're entering into very dangerous waters here. I can speak as the woman on the panel. I find in particular the weaponization of sexual assault allegations to be turned into political weapons to be a very dangerous territory. I think it's offensive to women in particular, and I think it's offensive to anyone who actually was sexually assaulted. We don't know yet if this particular accuser, if her account, which she doesn't remember much about it, doesn't remember, let's point out, how she actually got to the party that night some nearly 40 years ago, doesn't remember whose house it was, yet she's certain that it was Judge Kavanaugh that was in the room with her. So I think there are a lot of questions about this, but I think that the big question here really is, are we in these new uncharted waters? Yeah. And here's how I know. If it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it probably is a duck. I think this is a political hit job. How do we know? I've seen this twice before with my own eyes. We saw this in the Roy Moore case in the Alabama Senate race. We saw Gloria Allred come out and say there was this yearbook inscription that they were certain was Judge Roy Right. Moore from some 40 years ago. Again, very similar circumstance. Well, it turned out in the end, just a couple of days before the election, some handwriting and ink experts came forward and said that most of that inscription was a forgery,
Right.
That it had recently been written in, that his signature was accurate and likely from 40 years ago. But the inscription of like, hey, I'll meet you down at the restaurant was actually a forgery.
Okay.
You never heard about that case again.
No, of course.
But not until Judge Moore was dragged through the mud. What?
Exactly. I mean, we're going to talk about Russia in the second half of the program. Once something is disproved, it just disappears. Oh, it never really happened here. Lionel, let me go to you in New York. I mean, this is the weaponization of the Me Too movement, and it's because Kavanaugh is obviously a conservative. But when I talked about the destruction of institutions, the Senate committee that, you know, confirms him is to judge if he is competent to be a judge. And all through the 3 days, it was proven that he's more than competent. And in the 11th hour, and extra procedurally, we get this nonsense being thrown at him. The man can't even defend himself. Go ahead, Lionel.
Look, you know, when you call it the weaponization of Me Too, that makes it sound like there's some rhyme or reason to it. I'm a former prosecutor. Try picking up the phone right now, calling anybody, police, your local DA, and say, listen, I might have been attempted or an attempted rape may have occurred 36 years ago, which I want to bring up now, which is fine. And by the way, I've had the chance to talk to, or this particular person that I'm going to report on, has appeared six times during six different FBI investigations. And this person, who was the subject of my complaint, met with Dianne Feinstein, just happens to be a Supreme Court justice, for, I don't know, 1,000 questions. It never came up. Oh, and by the way, this thing that I'm bringing up now, they've known since July. I would be summarily removed from any consideration, not because of Me Too, not because women are not believed, but it's like this case is old, it is stale, there's a problem, and it is fraught with evidentiary problems. Now, if you can't even get a police department to pay attention to you, not because of the Me Too movement, not because of women, but because the case is just weak and there are real, serious, pending cases right. of rape where women remember everything about it, you're telling me that yet this holds water, holds weight for a Supreme Court nominee? This is an 11th hour Hail Mary, pathetic attempt on fight.
It's a political Hail Mary is what this is all about here. You know, Don, again, I look at principles and core ideas, and the whole presumption of innocence is being destroyed. This is a precedent that no matter who your political enemies, no matter, particularly if they're over 40 or in their 50s, you just go back to someone when they're 17, and you have no recourse. This is a dangerous, dangerous precedent to set because it can be used against anyone. Go ahead, Don.
First of all, let's remember the fact that we live in an irony-free zone and start with this irony. Much of the float that's being given to Christine Blasey Ford's case is being organized through MoveOn.org. Move on meaning after the accusations against Bill Clinton were made, drop all of that and move on. That was the basis of MoveOn.org, was to put aside. These were claims for women. One, Juanita Broderick, said she was raped. She was on television. She said, Bill Clinton raped me, not groped me as a teenager. As Arkansas Attorney General, when she was 35 years old, he raped me. Move on. Kathleen Willey, who said that on 60, she went on 60 Minutes and said that Bill Clinton assaulted her sexually, rubbed his Willie Jr. Against her will, and did so until what they call in the massage parlor business a happy ending. Okay, this also, move on from this. Leslie Milwee is a reporter who had similar experiences with that, and she said, I didn't report it because I saw what Bill and Hillary Clinton were doing to people that did report it. I was intimidated, even though I was a journalist, by the abuse, public abuse taken at the hands of those two people. And then, of course, Paula Jones, who, by the way, got paid $850,000 by Bill Clinton to shut up and go away.
Okay,
that is on the accuser's side, and move on. That's what we were supposed to move on from, and now they're working on the basis that they have against Kavanaugh, which is one person's recollection from that long ago against nothing else, no other evidence except two people who say, no, it didn't happen.
I don't even know if it actually did happen, considering
Peter,
everything. Jen, you're a Republican strategist, and I have an important question for you. Is the Republican Party, which I'm not a member of, I'm a conservative, but is the Republican Party going to grow a backbone and make sure this confirmation moves through? Because I really don't like them turning into warm milk, and I'm not going to name the names, but I mean, this, they are, it's really in their hands right now, okay? And I'm wondering, as a strategist, is a Republican Party going to do the right thing and not just go soft? Go ahead, in Las Vegas.
I think they are, Peter, and you see this here. Chuck Grassley is doing a phenomenal job of saying, look, we've afforded Ms. Ford every opportunity to come forward. We've offered her a private, shielded testimony. Never mind that Kavanaugh's been dragged through the mud. We're going to give her private testimony. But I think they're going to hold to this 10 a.m. Friday deadline that she has to come forward and say whether she will plan to testify and whether she'll plan to present any evidence of this. I think they're going to stick to that. But I think the big lesson here is that the Republican Party has finally learned their lesson. And going back to those examples I shared, that we've seen this type of political hit job before. Therefore, we know it's a political hit job. As a strategist in California for many years and a Schwarzenegger appointee, you might remember in the 2003 recall elections, this exact thing happened to Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yep.
So it was an October surprise situation. Gloria Allred brought out, I think it was 18 women who claimed that Governor Schwarzenegger had groped them, showed virtually no evidence of it. And guess what? Gloria Allred, in that case, just like the Roy Moore case in Alabama, said, no matter what, if he gets elected or not, we're going to pursue these cases to the ends of the earth. And guess what happened? After Election Day, those charges weren't pursued. The cases were dropped. They did move on. And that tells you right there that's a political
job.
Okay,
let me go to Lionel before we go to the break. You know, Lionel, as a former prosecutor, when someone accuses someone else, what kind of responsibilities must they take on to make that accusation in public? Because it seems like it's only Kavanaugh that has to take responsibilities for somebody else's word. Go ahead, Lionel.
Well, one of the things is that if they do involve the FBI in this and she has to give answer questions, there's this wonderful statute called 18 U.S.C. 1001, which says if you lie to the FBI, which is what they got Martha Stewart on, you're subject to criminal prosecution. But let me just guess something. And this is just conjecture on my part. Something tells me that somehow, I don't know why, we can go through her background and pedigree and provenance. But somebody said, here's one because it's an 11th hour political move. And they're going to pull her into this. And now she's claiming she was threatened, and that's awful, and we should all stand against that. But let me tell you something. When her attempt, when she's been pulled out, exposed, and she is no longer needed, watch how the Democratic Party just discards her. You will never hear anything about her again. You will never see any follow-up. How are you doing? Thanks for nothing. Because this is the big messages to the next person who decides that you're going to come forward. Watch what happened to Anita Hill and watch what happens here. This is what they do. This is how you're used.
And
you're the star of the hour, and then you're discarded.
Right, particularly when we have people in the GOP saying, well, she really doesn't need to speak to the authorities. Okay. All right. I'm going to jump in here after a short break. We'll continue our discussion on political gridlock. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World
on CPR.
Well, let me go back to Don. It's finally happening. It should have happened a long time ago. Donald Trump is ordering the release of documents related to the Carter Page FISA warrant and all other documents from the intelligence community regarding Russia, which I'm so sick of after 2 years. This document release could clear up a lot of things and tie up a lot of loose ends, my humble opinion. But of course, the intelligence community is fighting back with congressional Democrats. Go ahead, Don.
Well, first of all, I'm going to state something that has been my position since the Church hearings back in the 70s. I hope that somehow Trump gets to light and orders the release of all the documents ever created by the CIA, and that includes releasing the techniques and statecraft and everything that they've used to do all of the nefarious things they've done since Harry Truman founded them in the 40s. So that's just my framework. What we're talking about here is an allegation with pretty strong, firsthand evidence in front of everybody, more or less, that the intelligence agencies have tampered with, have meddled in the political process here, that they abused a court that is itself an abuse of the Constitution, the FISA court, ran right over the so-called safeguards, exposing that there are none, and used that court for political purposes so that they could wiretap one of the campaigns, feed the information to the other campaign, use it to discredit the first campaign, the subject campaign, and then use it to tie up the presidency after that campaign became the administration. Yep. To me, that is a pile of compounded felonies, including, the treason word that they've been throwing around, unprecedented in American history.
Yep. Jen, let me go back to you. I'll go back to my favorite mantra here. Donald Trump, as the elected, inaugurated president of the United States, he can release any document he wants. That is his presidential prerogative. It is written into the Constitution. And now we have this insurrection going on and watching those clowns over at CNN and MSNBC saying this is a threat to our security. No, it's a threat to their security, because the truth will come out. They're not protecting the United States and the American people or the world. They're protecting their lower back ends. Go ahead, in Las Vegas.
Right. And the truth of the matter is the wiretapping threatened every American security. Look, we still don't know the reason why Samantha Power, the UN ambassador, unmasked the identity of nearly 400 Americans under her own name. She was just one player in the Obama administration. Add to that Susan Rice and many others in the administration of Barack Obama that were spying on Americans. And so I think President Trump did the right thing here. You look at someone like Carter Page, a private citizen who was clearly dragged through the mud. Even some of the mainstream media is admitting to that now, that after a year of being under investigation, Carter Page may not have been involved in some of these activities as the Obama administration suggested he was. And boy, I'm glad to see transparency here. It's funny when the shoe is on the other foot, though.
Yeah.
Democrats are always hollering about transparency and accountability in the intelligence agencies. When did the roles reverse? When did Washington become even swampier than before?
Well,
Democrats usually would support this kind of thing, but they're not, because they don't like Trump.
No, because their messiah president was the most secretive president in American history. Lionel, jump in.
Right.
In 1971, there was a group called the Citizens Committee to Investigate the FBI, and they broke in. These are a bunch of real leftists, real progressive liberal leftists, who broke in to the Media Pennsylvania FBI office, stole information, and showed the media, look what the FBI is doing. That later involved or revealed COINTELPRO, which led to the Church Committee, and the left. The actual left, real liberals, Constitution flag-waving patriots of the left, they used to look at the intel state, the deep state, the police state, as the enemy. Something happened. Some kind of weird, some type of sedative or something was placed intravenously into the collective conscience of these people. And now the left, the people who portray these progressives, they're the ones arguing for more of this intel state abuse. Now, Carter Page is going to be one of the richest people in the world because the American people still don't understand what he did. He had a Title I FISA warrant on him. And to look at him in public, I don't know if he was, he kind of seems kind of duped and dismayed and dazed, but this is an individual who had the full force, the absolute weight of the intel state. And the problem is that when you see the Rachel Maddows and all these people who, by the way, interview the oven mitt fashionista who all of a sudden is speaking about, you know, rape reform and that sort of thing. But the left, these people who fancy themselves as being believers in the Constitution, now are indeed what the right used to be. This is a complete switcheroo. I don't know who's in charge anymore.
Okay, I think I do. Don here, I mean, it wasn't until December of 2016. I mean, in my circles, we referred to the deep state all of the time. But, you know, the New York Times would never use that phrase. CNN didn't even know what it meant. They don't even know what much means these days. But it is the deep state. They don't want their power taken away from them. And in that sense, it's not really so left or right. They're there. They're deeply embedded in it. And they know that once these documents, when they're released grudgingly, they're going to expose more and more and more. And we're going to see people throwing people under the bus. It's going to be a really traumatic event. Of course, they want to focus on everything else except for what's really going on. If you're watching CNN and MSNBC, you barely have an idea this stuff is going on. It is so lopsided right now. Go ahead, Don.
You know, it's kind of frightening, too, because the objective context is this thing that's now called the deep state has been around long enough for it to have had previous names. The one I remember in the period that Lionel's talking about was the permanent government.
Right.
And it's the same characters. I assume that the label on the paycheck that goes out to them got changed at some point in the last few years from Permanent Government Inc. to Deep State Inc. or LLC or whatever. What the rallying cry is, I mean, certainly the position of people who are held out to be leftists, who claim to be leftists, you know, in public, vis-a-vis the intelligence agencies, has done a 180-degree shift from calling for their dismantling back in the Church Committee times and viewing them as the enemy, you know, talk to Professor Churchill, for example, to, you know, holding them out as the saviors of our democratic society, which is the nonsense that we hear now. But the larger narrative is even more frightening because these intelligence agencies are claiming to protect us, the American public, from getting too friendly with Russia when essentially we should be preparing for war. And that, to me, is the central policy that's being sold in the public. And that means that somewhere it's somebody's intended policy going forward. And it's a very dangerous policy, obviously.
You know, Jen, the thing is I'm glad I'm glad that John brought up the Church Committee because maybe a lot of our viewers weren't even born by then. But it really was a scathing review of the behavior of the intelligence community. But the press was genuinely interested. The media was genuinely interested and put their feet to the fire. Look what we have today now. They're just a continuation of this deep state in the way they report on this. John Brennan, for goodness sake, is an honored contributor on MSNBC. I can't wait to see that guy sweat. Go ahead, Jen, in Las Vegas.
Right. Well, to Lionel's point that something changed along the way, it's funny you mentioned John Brennan. I was just about to say the thing that changed is that the Democrats finally realized that all they needed was a vein to get into the intelligence community of the United States. And the person who injected the Fusion GPS document, which, by the way, was paid for by Hillary Clinton and the DNC, all they needed was a vein, a way to get it into the intel community, and they did so through John Brennan. And if you look at Brennan, I love that President Trump revoked his security clearance and his right to rifle through all the intelligence briefings. Guess what? You guys notice the leaks have stopped since that happened. And what does that tell you? That tells you that John Brennan was indeed the leaker. He did have a political axe to grind. And by the way, you're not supposed to be allowed to be a paid network contributor and also have access to highly classified intelligence briefings. That, in my opinion, as someone who went through Journalism 101 in college, knows better than that. But unfortunately, the lines in Washington these days are so mixed that was allowed to happen. And and it's a real shame.
You know, Lionel, we haven't heard much from James O'Lordy Comey lately. I wonder why. Is it connected to the fact that his name is going to get back in the news again in a big, big way? That's why he wrote the book and sold it before it happened. Mark my words, he's going to need money for legal fees. Go ahead, Lionel.
Well, if you want to see what's interesting, go to, of course, social media and look at the image he's portraying. He's at Mount Rushmore, and he's feeding reading to the blind, and he's doing everything he can because he realizes that the hammer's about to drop. Let me explain something. This might be one of the greatest presidents in my lifetime if all he does is simply, well, two things. Number one, destroy what was left of the fascist sock puppet, Ted Baxter Media, and expose the people that the intel state, the FBI, the CIA, and by the by, let me remember, there are many, many white hats, as they're called, good people out there, FBI agents investigating, bank robberies, and CIA people doing really good job. It's this upper echelon. We're not talking about the entire institutional aspects of it being corrupt and being feculent and rotten by this, but just the certain levels of this. But and also, I want to go back. If you thought J. Edgar Hoover was bad, if you thought Watergate
was bad,
all
right, Elena, we've run out of time. But mentioning J. Edgar Hoover is very appropriate at this point here. Many thanks to my guests in New York, Austining, and in Las Vegas. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.